Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the Sleary Report. Today is October 3rd, 2019. I'm Catherine Austin Fitz, and I'm delighted you could join me this evening. Oh, I hope you want to live in interesting times, because we do. We have a lot to talk about tonight. I arrived in the Netherlands 2 days ago, and I will be here until mid-month, and then I'm going to Basel, Switzerland, where I'll do a workshop in Basel with Thomas Miro on October 20th. And then I head over to Chartres with Thomas. We'll film there. And then I'm attending Spaces of Resonance in the 72 Names of God. It's a workshop that Ulrich Gonegger is going to give in Chartres. I'm attending, and several great Sleary Report subscribers. So you can find the link to their website at the Sleary event page if you're interested in coming. Then I fly back to the States at the end of the month. Nina Hein and Robert are going to meet me in Paris to see the Da Vinci. So more Leonardo da Vinci coming. We did a great interview with John Rappaport, in fact, on Leonardo. So more coming on that. And then Portland, I'll be in Portland for RT on Friday, November 15th. And then I'm driving back to Hickory Valley through the Panhandle, where I'll be for Thanksgiving. And then an event in Malvern outside of Philadelphia in Friday, December 20th. So I'll see all you folks in Pennsylvania, and some great New Yorkers came down as well. The Hang at Lake Constance in August 2020. We still have places available. It's a phenomenal group that signed up. We have people from Australia, the UK, Switzerland, Hong Kong, Germany, all different parts of the US, Austria. I'm limiting it to 20 people. But we still have a few slots. I recorded a great discussion with Jason Bodensmith and Ulrich Gonegger. I was hoping to get it up this week, but probably next week. And it'll give you a chance to listen about what the discussion is going to be about. I think it's going to be fascinating. It's a great group. So if you're interested, take a look. You can just link from the homepage or the event section. It has its own web presentation, but you should automatically log in after you've logged into Sleary. And don't forget the real game of missing money. Please keep circulating it. We're sending out lots and lots of copies, lots of PDFs, trying to get money managers and people interested in all sorts of angles on the money management side to take a look and understand this. And we have a new... when we put up the new Just a Taste, we have a great new campaign for the, I don't want to give it away. So just take a look. I'll just give you the meme, 2020-21. So because I think the campaign is a great time to get the discussion in. Our theme tonight is long knives in the three Western power centers. There are three serious centers of power in the Western world. One is the City of London. One is the Vatican City, and the other is the District of Columbia. And what we see is the long knives are out and people stabbing each other, you know, frontally and in the back, all through those three centers. The fight is really on, and it's getting very serious. In the City of London, the financial center globally, we have the Brexit debate. And we saw last week Boris Johnson, who in fact used to be the mayor of the city, referred for criminal investigation. So we're going at each other with razor blades. He put together a new plan. The plan is not going to go. And so the question is there going to be a hard Brexit or a delay? But I'm absolutely convinced that there will be a Brexit. And the reason is, if you look at how things are emerging, the only potential serious contender right now to the dollar is the Eurozone. It's the one currency that can take some real capacity, but it needs to get through this period of difficulty. And if you're Britain, it's clear Europe is going to, and particularly Northern Europe, is going to put together a military force to sort of back what they're doing, and the euro, particularly as they're sort of drawing a little bit away from the politics in the U.S. And so Britain's got to go with the Commonwealth and the dollar zone, or it's got to go with the Eurozone. It can't go one or the other. There was some disinformation about a week or two that Joseph and I talk about in this interview, where Lord Blackheath was trying to persuade everybody that as soon as they stayed, they'd have to turn over their nuclear arsenal. Well, that's kind of a fast forward of what would happen in the very long term if they did go with the euro and the Eurozone at some point, you know, you're going to see a real integration, including on the military. So it's kind of, I said to Joseph, it's disinformation, but there's a gist of truth. You know, sometimes the intelligence agencies and the people in charge of selling these things don't believe that you can understand or relate to long ball. So they just accelerate it up and say it's going to happen tomorrow. And somehow that makes it clear for the people in the audience. Anyway, here's the thing. If you look at the development of the Silk Road, it's really one of the things that's forcing this decisions. You have Europe with 750 million consumers and connected up with the Silk Road with Asia and a rising Asia. And if you look at the money and the politics of that, Britain either has to choose sort of jumping in the European Union and making that go, or they have to choose the Commonwealth, which I think the Queen clearly has. If Italy leaves, it's going to make the EU and the Euro a lot less settled. And so that's part of why the politics of what are happening in Italy are so front and center right now. Vatican City is the, yes, it's the sort of the titular head of the Catholic Church, but it's also the vestiges of the Holy Roman Empire. They sort of hid behind a church and kept going financially. We saw the Vatican police raid the Secretary of State for their financial records. And if you have been following the indictment and conviction of Cardinal Pell in Australia, it appears probably related to that if you look at the dates. But these are, you know, for one part of the Vatican to basically be seizing the financial records of another through the Vatican police is pretty, that's pretty dicey politics. So again, we see those criminal allegation razor blades out and people fighting over the money. And then District of Columbia, which is really the center for military and intelligence, if you look at the effort to unseat Trump before the 2020 election, Russiagate didn't make any progress. Literally the day after Mueller sort of killed Russiagate, that's when this new whistleblower effort started. And an enormous effort. This is the most powerful a shriek-o-meter has ever been turned on a president. And they're trying to get Trump to lose his temper and melt down in a manner that would erode his support with his base. And it's quite extraordinary what he's being put to. And they know exactly where his weaknesses are. So, you know, so he's making a lot of mistakes in the process of trying to best them. He's had Barr in both Italy and also talking with the British intelligence about essentially investigating Russiagate and what's that about. And obviously the other investigations going on are what Biden and the Obama administration was up in up to in Ukraine, which was very, very deeply dirty. Trump has a clear mandate from the population to drain the swamp. And he can rightly and fairly say all these different investigations are doing just exactly that. But needless to say, the swamp does not want to be investigated, and they have great powers. So look at these three, essentially the greatest power centers overtly in the Western world, the city, Vatican, and D.C., and we see the Blasto-Midianite thing happening in all three centers. Now, if you don't know what I mean by the Midianite thing, you should listen to the Gideon interview I did with Thomas Meyer in the story of Gideon. Gideon and his army come down the sides of the mountains with lanterns and pitchers bringing transparency. And the Midianites are so evil and hateful that they jump up in the dark and kill each other. But that's what you're seeing in a highly centralized system. You're seeing the leadership basically going at each other with razor blades. I used to be a deputy assistant secretary at HUD, and say, you know, this is like people going at each other with razor blades on a rubber life raft. It doesn't make any sense. But the criminal allegations in covert warfare are significant. And there are other signs, which we'll talk about later, about covert warfare all over the globe. So let's step back and say, why are all these centers of power having such internecine warfare and politics? In a sense, we have a perfect storm. the Western world tried to get the unipolar model done, failed. In the meantime, you've had a financial coup. A lot of money has been moved out. I'll bet a lot of it's in those British offshore havens that the city's protecting. But wherever it is, it's gone from the access by the body politic, so to speak. And that obviously creates tension. But you also have an effort top down to implement technocracy. If you haven't listened to the interview I did with Patrick Wood on technocracy, I strongly recommend it, and also a follow-up on opportunity zones and more about technocracy. So the general population doesn't like this. They don't like the idea of a Neuralink being stuck in their head. They don't like the idea of a chip being put in their arm. They don't like the idea of their kids having heavy metal shot into their vein when they don't want it. They don't want to have to be told they have to put heavy metals into their kids, not just their vein, but their brain, so that they can go to a school that they're paying for through their property taxes. So, you know, technocracy and the invasion of somebody's privacy, health, all these different things is there's real serious pushback happening all over the planet, and it looks different in different places. So it looks different in Hong Kong than the Yellow Jackets look in France, but it's basically the same thing. The debt growth model is over, and so for a long time while the financial coup is going on, what you would see in the government budgets is the general population who didn't like what was happening would be bought off continually with, you know, here's money for your team. And now that the debt growth model is over and you have to go to real economic reform, the question is, you don't have money to buy people off. In fact, now you're basically saying we don't need you anymore. You're taking the money away. And they're getting a little antsy about that and figuring out that you've just stolen $50 trillion. In the meantime, we have peak everything. I always tell the story of the famous investor Jimmy Rogers at a gold conference who said, do you believe in peak oil? He said, peak oil's not the problem. It's peak everything. You have more people and you've been using up a lot of resources, and now you got to dig deeper to get less. One of the biggest problems is that the leadership, whether it's at the city, at the Vatican, or at the District of Columbia, they don't agree on what the new model is. The unipolar model failed, but they don't agree about how they're going to approach the multipolar model. It's not all worked out. So you have diminishing cash flows, rising risk, and people frustrated about what the model's going to be. To a certain extent, the debate is between the globalists and the nationalists. And, of course, the globalists want a global taxation system, and technocracy, and the way they think they're going to get it is through climate change. Climate change will allow you to radically reduce people's footprint. So you can, you know, you can, instead of letting inflation get away, you just demand destruct through climate change regulation. It's interesting, when I got off the plane in the Netherlands, the farmers here were in an uproar because they're trying to really slam down on their resource use on a theory because of climate change. But these guys are very capable and smart and know it's all yeah. So anyway, you got the globalists who want to come up with a global taxation. And what did they do last week? But they had Greta from Sweden come and make you know, sort of the twilight child conversation from the UN. Then Trump showed up and instead of speaking for the, you know, the global tax for the globalists on the theory that we need to feel terrible about how terrible we'd been to the environment, somehow that would make it all right. Anyway, Trump showed up and spoke on behalf of the National Sovereignty Group. It's interesting. We just saw the Australian Prime Minister do the same. So Trump's speech at the UN was quite, I'm sure, quite a shock for many of the globalists in the room who were very pleased with what they just achieved with the highly emotional Swedish teenager. In the meantime, we have new technology that is changing many different industries and the communication between all sorts of different groups. Just a perfect example this week, the many of the several of the U.S. brokerage firms went to zero commissions. E-Trade was the latest to announce today, and that's $300 million suddenly gone from their revenues. So it's quite extraordinary. It was set off by Interactive Brokers and then followed this week by Schwab, and then E-Trade, and I think Meritrade somewhere got in there. So suddenly you're watching hundreds of millions of revenues suddenly get wiped off, but there's real pressure to keep the stock market going, and that is clearly going to be attractive to retail. There's a great quote from Einstein, something to the effect of, new technology goes through society like giving an axe to a pathological serial killer. But so the leadership in the power centers is dealing not only with how more transparent technology makes things, but also the way it hiccups and changes the cash flows in unpredictable ways. It's just more risk, more to manage. Now, falling cash flows are always a problem when you have heavy debt, and we've loaded up on the debt since the financial crisis, particularly in the emerging markets, and a lot of that debt is denominated in dollars. And now the economy is slowing, which means it's harder to earn dollars. We're repositioning, rebalancing the trade with China. It's harder for them to earn dollars, but now everybody needs dollars to pay their debt. And so the extent to which the dollar is now being used and coming with economic sanctions and being played as a political weapon significantly increases the tensions. And what that means is there's tremendous pressure in the financial system to have a calm and stable hand managing the dollar. And I'm sure the people concerned about this do not think of Trump and his administration as a calm and stable hand to manage the dollar. It was really funny. The Peggy Noonan's column today quoted one GOP staffer as saying, the president is an unsettled man. And so I think the money people are getting a little bit nervous because Trump is very aggressive about wanting to use tariffs and economic sanctions and all sorts of other things that have an advantage in terms of negotiation, but can really create enormous liquidity problems around the planet. And in the long run, really threaten the dollar's status. I don't think you'd be seeing all the moves you're seeing in Europe to reposition the euro to take a bigger role in the global currency reserves unless they were very concerned with what's going on in Washington politics. Anyway, so we have a major push for a Trump impeachment, and it's very bizarre the way it happened. Normally, when you have the House move for impeachment, they take a vote. You didn't have that. You had the speaker basically say, there's six committees investigating Trump. I hereby declare them to be an impeachment inquiry. And oh, by the way, we're all leaving town for 2 weeks while the media will pummel this thing to death. I'm assuming she didn't have the votes, and she certainly didn't want the sort of the Congress critters with moderate districts, including districts that voted for Trump. She didn't want them to go back and get absolutely killed during the recess. Now, what happened? What triggered this? As I said, the day that Mueller messed up on Russiagate, literally, the work on this one started almost the next day, if you look at the timing of the thing. But the question is, what did Trump do to ring the bell, or what happened in the economy to ring the bell? One is there's definitely a need for a distraction from what's happening with the U.S. budget and what's happening in the U.S. financial markets. So distraction is one, and I assure you, this is kind of a stack function things. The second is we have a lot of people in Congress and a lot of people on the Democratic side who are dirty up to their eyeballs in Ukraine dirt and I suspect Iran deal dirt. And the last thing they need is Trump opening up, or getting people in the Ukraine and other countries. He just invited the Chinese to investigate Joe Biden. But the last thing they need is Trump opening all those issues up. And we'll talk about that a little more in a second. And then finally, I think because of what's happening with the dollar and this real currency war now, or the potential for a real currency war, I think you have people on the Republican side and the intelligence agencies who are interested in engineering regime change. And the question is, how do they do that? Impeachment is not the best way to do that. Simply moving them out and putting somebody else to win the Republican nomination and then the presidency is the better way. One thing, to Trump's advantage, they clearly don't want Pence. So I think the question is, how do you get rid of Trump but still maintain the, you know, they still want to see a Republican win. So it's tricky business. And as we would say, the politics of this thing are very fluid. As I said, you know, Russiagate failed. So now the Democrats certainly needed a plan B. I think this started, as I said, immediately after Mueller testified and it was clear that Russiagate was dead. Now, let's go through some of the playbook. It's straight out of the one they used me. They used on me, and I suspect because of that, this is probably the CIA has to be involved. And it's very frustrating if you're the president, because if the CIA is involved, they're clearly more loyal to whoever they're working for than the president, even though technically they work for the president. The first thing you have is a phony whistleblower. The Obama administration at the end of their term, who had been very unfriendly to whistleblowers, suddenly changed the laws so that you can do a whistleblow even though you don't have original information, which as far as I'm concerned is just a joke. So the fact that this guy is sweeping up secondhand information and doesn't have original information, to me, he's not a whistleblower. Now, the director of intelligence said this is a sincere guy and he believes he's serious about this, which may be the case. But if you look at the thing that was written with his signature, obviously redacted, we don't yet know who he is, although we suspect he's one of the CIA analysts who rolled through the National Security Council. Anyway, but if you look at how it's written, more than one person wrote this. This was not the written material of one guy. And I suspect today or yesterday, Trump accused the Adam Schiff of having written it. So I don't think that Schiff wrote it. I bet it was a group of lawyers who probably work for Schumer or work for the CIA or, you know, some group. But I think this was a committee effort. And one of the things that's come out is this guy contacted Schiff before he wrote or filed it, which stinks to high heaven. So if you look at who the whistleblower is and the fact that it's not original material, that he talked to Schiff before he wrote it, and it looks like, you know, 12 law firms were part of writing it and making sure the footnotes were perfect. The whole thing is just, as I said last week, the Wall Street Journal basically said, this is a joke. This does not pass the test. Now, in the meantime, they're threatening Trump's attorneys with disbarment. They used to always do that to me. Anytime I had an attorney, they try and scare him off. The last thing they're doing is projective identification. They're clearly attacking Trump for doing what they were doing. And it's one of the things you do when you're terrified you're going to be attacked. You look at what Trump was asking the Ukrainians to investigate. There's a lot of dirty laundry there, and laundry that could send a lot of very powerful people to jail if it really was investigated and then indictments came down. So let me talk about what I think was going on. First of all, Biden was flying around both the Ukraine and China with his son, and his son was getting the kickbacks because he, as vice president, couldn't. So he was just arranging for the money to go in through his son's bank account instead of his. His son was no more qualified for those different positions or opportunities than the man in the moon. And the thing stinks from high heaven. And he's on record, I think it was at the Council of Foreign Relations or someplace like that, basically telling them, you know, that if they didn't do what he wanted, the IMF loan wouldn't come through. And my guess, a lot of that IMF loan, certainly a sizable piece, ended up being kicked back by the Ukrainians back to American politicians and their pals. So what you're seeing is, and we've been seeing this for a long time, the U.S. make loans or the IMF make loans, and the money, you know, it one banker once said to me, you know, the money in the Mexican bailout just it never went to Mexico. It just went from one bank account at J.P. Morgan Chase to another bank account at J.P. Morgan Chase to another bank account at J.P. Morgan Chase. It never left the country. Anyway, so I think that kickbacks to political leaders in the United States is a very likely possibility. The second thing is this may be connected to the Iran deal. There have been constant rumors and allegations that the Iran deal, which was never approved by the Senate, and they say is there's no formal written agreement. Essentially, what we did is we took the money that we had frozen, we gave it back to Iran, and the understanding was that all the political leaders involved would receive personal kickbacks. Now, again, that's just rumors. That's just speculation. But it would explain a lot because apparently when Trump canceled the Iranian deal, you know, the kickbacks, the Iranians wanted their money back. And there may have been more payments that were expected that now aren't coming through. Now, imagine you're a bunch of globalists and Trump cancels the Paris Climate Accord, the climate agreement. And so now your global tax disappears. And now he's messing with your Iranian kickbacks. And you've got allies all over in Europe who's willing to continue with the deal, screaming because they don't want their kickbacks to have to come back. So you've got problems not only of your own cash flow, but you've got big problems with all the allies around the world who are really, really mad and have the power. You know, if you look at the dirt they have on you, talk about the Midianite thing, if they decided to get mad and dish out the dirt. So I suspect that a lot of cash flows were hiccuped on the Iran deal, certainly on the Paris Agreement, and now you know, who knows what could get dug out on the Ukraine. Now, in the meantime, right after Trump announced that he wanted to meet and negotiate with the Iranians and he didn't want to go to war, and then he fired Bolton, his polls rose tremendously. Go over to Rasmussen and take a look at they do a daily presidential approval. His polls were just skyrocketing up, and he closed September with his best polls for a month in 2 years. And I think that's the problem for the people who want a war. And certainly, you know, if Trump sits down with the Iranians and they give him chapter and verse on the kickbacks, ooh, I don't think they want a meeting with the Iranians. But I don't think it has anything to do with global politics. I think it has to do with, you know, kickbacks and how you make money in a war. Anyway, if you thought Trump sitting down with Putin drove the Democrats crazy, you should see what him sitting down with Iran drove them crazy. Now, right in the middle of this, Netanyahu loses his election. And in fact, he's got hearings starting today, pretrial hearings on the criminal charges against him. So we'll see. He was offered a chance to put together to form a coalition government. It failed. He's talking about more elections, but the reality is, you know, the thing in front of him is he could be indicted. So Netanyahu is really sidelined in a very interesting way. And so if you whether the problem is the kickbacks, whether the problem is the global tax, whether the problem is the information that could flow from the Iranians, the Democrats are scared to death. And they're sufficiently scared that they don't want to take a vote. They just want to say, okay, the committees can do their thing. We don't need a vote. We don't need to be held accountable. We don't need to explain ourselves. We're just going to do this and leave town and see if we can't gin up enough support in the media and in our work back home with the constituents to make this go and make this stick, even though if you look at the merits of what they have, it's not a lot. Anyway, the other question is, do they need a distraction? If you look at what's been happening in the repo market, we've seen real seizures up in liquidity, and there are a couple things going on. You've got new regulations causing the banks to want to stockpile cash. You've got the U.S. dollar bear trap, which is really an emerging markets problem, but it can cause real short-term liquidity issues. Then you have Deutsche Bank and the European banks having a challenging time because, as I said, they didn't stick it to the taxpayers the way we did. So our banks are in much better shape. But if, again, because of the regulations, they want to have big cash positions as well as what's going on in the world. And so part of the problem with the Fed is you're going to help the world's liquidity globally, or are you going to go along with the Trump plan? Now, Trump's happy when more money pumps out because it's generally been supportive of the stock market. But the Fed is in a very tricky position. And the last thing, of course, is the U.S. debt is spiraling up tremendously. And we passed a $1 trillion deficit for the year, so we probably end the year about $1.2 trillion. The Congress has not been able to come up with a new budget. The beginning of the new budget year is October 1st. What they did is they voted a continuing resolution through November. But I think they're going to have a real problem because the social safety net is going to continually get cut as we go through, every new round on the budget. And the reality is you've got the Democrats running around, whether it's Elizabeth Warren or Bernie Sanders or AOC, promising the sun, the moon, and the stars and things that are, from a fiscal stimulus standpoint, very, very liberal. And yet, if any of that is supposed to be real during election time, how can any of that be real if you're cutting out the most basic of social safety net? So I think the last thing the Democrats want, I think they need a real distraction away from the real deal on the debt spiral and the budget and what it means to what they're going to support in terms of cutting the social safety net and what that means to the election. So again, you've got the general population and the three centers of power grappling with the end of a period of false prosperity that was used to basically flow the financial coup and has led into the failure of the unipolar model. And of course, at some point, people are going to figure out what happened. And then the question is, okay, who are you going to blame? So again, you have a major competition over the model. And in the meantime, you've got to manage the general population. And you've decided not to explain anything to them. You're just going to divide and conquer and give them a false reality. And that's a very ugly picture. And one that's very loaded with all sorts of manipulation, propaganda, and entrainment, not to mention false flags. So when the cash slows down and failure's in the air, there's pretty big tensions. We've seen, and Joseph and I talk about in the interview tonight, discussions and pretty open discussions by leadership about the fact that the unipolar model has failed, from Carney, from Macron, from Lavrov, and we have seen several pieces publicly of real serious whacks of Trump by the leadership for failure of leadership, one from Mattis, one from Tillerson, and we now have Napolitano, the judge who's always on Fox News, now running around and saying what Trump has done is an impeachable offense and on and on and on, and you wonder kind of what in the world's gotten into him. One of the things that's interesting is the question is, for the people who are exceptionally opposed to Trump, is their objection the fact that he's an unsettled person and his style is very unpresidential? Because to the extent they say he's a criminal, you kind of shake your head and think, well, you know, the last four administrations have been distinctly an out-of-control criminal. What is it about Trump? I think there's been funny business around some of the Jared Kushner deals and other things. So I'm not saying funny business isn't going on, but if you look at Trump compared to the Bushes or the Clintons or the some of the stuff going on in Obama, I don't know. You know, if I had a choice of mobsters, I'd prefer Trump. But there's no doubt Mattis's piece is very fair because he talks about the extent to which Trump really destroys allies who we need and how important it is to have allies and not waste your political capital. It's worth reading his piece. Anyway, I think Trump has the political support to make it through this. The 2020 election is his to lose. His polls are still ahead of where Obama was at this point in the cycle. So, and if you read the Wall Street Journal editorial last week, they said it pretty well. If you look at what the Democrats have in terms of impeachable offense, as far as I can see, they've got absolutely nothing, which means you get over to the Republican side after you go through the House. So let's say the House, because they have a Democratic majority, votes to impeach. It goes over the Senate and dies there because you need two-thirds of the Senate. And you got no chance of getting it. You got to get 20 Republican senators to go along. Now, maybe there's a Republican who there's enough money guys on the Republican side who would go with it if it built to the right place. But to do that, they're going to have to get Pence out first and get the right guy in position. Their other option is basically to go to Trump and say, we'll get you a get-out-of-jail-free card for you and your family if you leave now and you let us sort of put this new guy in as a nominee or you don't run. So in theory, you could get a negotiated deal, but Trump's a fighter. And my guess is he's going to tough it through. And what he needs to do is he needs to learn how to be a lot less thin-skinned and a lot more savvy. Why he was foolish enough to make that kind of phone call, given the fact that 17 intelligence agencies are listening and have access, I just thought it was baffling. One of my favorite sports, or I shouldn't say favorite, one of the ones I find most interesting is the Royal Bushkaji, which is a forerunner of polo played in Afghanistan. If you watch Rambo 3 or a wonderful movie with Omar Sharif called The Horseman, you'll see two teams on basically Mongolian ponies go at each other. They all carry whips, and it's like a polo game. You don't have a ball. You have a body of a dead lamb, and you're your job is to get it and ride it around the other team's goalpost. And the rules are that there are no rules, that the other team is supposed to whip you until the pain is so great you drop the body of the dead lamb. And that's what, you know, Trump's got the body of the dead lamb, and they're just going to whip him until he drops it. And so the question is, can he negotiate through that? He has the political support to do it, because ultimately, what people see is who's about the business of the country. And I think the Democrats have put themselves in terrible risk because the extent to which they're ignoring the country. And when the budget comes out, they're going to be cutting the social, the social safety net. And if the word comes out about, if it turns out that they have been taking bribes, I just think it's all going to reverberate back. But then I've been wrong before because I always underestimate how effective the entrainment is. It's interesting, though, the end of the unipolar model means a lot of very richly subsidized people are increasingly going to have to learn to support themselves in the world they created. They created a world which is not a nice world, and it's a mean world, and it's hard to make a living in the world they created. And so they've created a pretty tough world to go out and have to support themselves. Imagine Nancy Pelosi having to feed herself by working as a cleaning lady at Super 8 Motel. Not a pretty picture. The biggest problem in all of this is what we're watching is a tremendous amount of money and time going into not dealing with the issues in front of us. They're too busy worrying about who's going to be in control and what the model's going to be. And those are important questions. But what it means is major gridlock. And that's always one of the problems with centralization. So unfortunately, in the background, the deep state is working away to get things teed up for major privatization after the election. And they're going to use all the distraction and mess to argue for why privatization is smart and effective. More on that, we're going to be doing more on that this quarter and other things. But the question for the rest of us is, how do we make progress in our lives and locally? Clearly, there's a need for much greater resiliency personally and locally. And what we're gonna hear and see from Washington increasingly is a drain. But it's a reminder, if you have a good congressman, or there's some very good congressmen there, but anything we can do to support the intelligent and solution-oriented people in that milieu, we need to do it. So if you don't love your congressman, there are plenty of others. Find them and support them. And, the more intelligent, calm people we have going into that process and trying to get something done, the better. Money and markets. Let's take a look at the returns year to date. The U.S. dollar now up 3.09%. Whatever the liquidity hiccups are, it's not because people are dumping dollars. There's plenty of demand for dollars thanks to major dollar debt. I think the dollar is under tremendous strain because people are doing everything they can not to be over a dollar barrel. Again, we're using the dollar as a political weapon. So I think there's a real institutional push to create capacity away. And of course, we know the globalists want a global currency. But the challenge in all of this is that a currency to work needs trust. And if you look at all the different governance and management systems that we're talking about, I would say the general population doesn't trust them. So the question is, and of course, everybody wants to put them on digital systems. And we know from watching, all the hacking and all the ransomware, the last thing anybody wants to trust is digital systems. So there's quite a challenge. More on that when I publish the currency theme for the last wrap up. Okay, fixed income, the long treasury back down a little bit. It's up 20.36 for the year, which is an astonishing performance. The intermediate up 10.27, the aggregate bond up 8.59%, the junk up 11.15%. It's amazing that junk is doing that well given the credit issues, but the Fed has made clear that they will pump. Very, very bad news. We see the administration agree to let Fannie and Freddie keep a bigger portion of their profits. That's anticipating that they are getting ready to privatize. And Mnuchin, Secretary of the Treasury, is proposing, and in some of the latest reports, to give Freddie and Fannie a full faith and credit wrap. So Freddie and Fannie can wrap mortgages all day long and give them the full faith and credit of the U.S. Treasury when, in fact, their profits are going private. So the taxpayer takes all of the risk and the investors get all of the profit. Imagine. Can you imagine? This is, talk about the worst of private aid. This is piracy. This is, well, I'm back to piratization. This is so ugly. Now, when you combine a full faith and credit wrap for Freddie and Fannie, and of course you have it with Ginnie on FHA, what you're talking about is the ability to take black budget mortgage fraud to the moon. If you think the housing crisis was bad, I mean, we can take it to the moon. And right now, Freddie, Fannie, and FHA are holding, they have about $7 trillion outstanding, which is significantly more than in the housing bubble the last time. Now, you had a full faith and credit to Fannie and Freddie when they're private. And remember, you can't FOIA Freddie and Fannie. So you're going to give them the full faith and credit, but they can do all the mortgage fraud because you can't FOIA them. They're a private organization. So this is FASB 56 for mortgages. And when you combine this for FASB 56, you are talking about taking an entire federal credit mechanism and basically turning it over to a bunch of private corporations and banks. You know, this is fascism on steroids. It's very, very bad. And so on one hand, I'm very grateful to Trump for canceling the Paris Agreement and telling the globalists, we want to be national sovereignists. But if you look at what we're doing actually with the money, this is straight into this is not only, fascism on steroids, but it's a really unproductive, bad idea, fascism on steroids. Interestingly enough, the head of Allianz blasted the ECB for cutting interest rates. And that's because if you look at the pain, you know, the pension funds and insurance companies have been holding on and holding on, thinking this was a phase that would be over. And now that they're seeing they're going into a very long-term low and negative interest rate environments, they know you could destroy the pension funds, you could destroy the insurance companies, and you could certainly destroy trust throughout the economy, which is what's happening. Now, one of the things that I keep warning about is corporate and high-yield bonds have a lot of maturities, refinancings to do over the next 2 years, 2-3 years. And I think once that happens, boy, the long knives are going to get worse because there's going to be a real fight for capital. Now, the way you solve that problem is what I think the deep state is positioning to do, which is basically turn over the government to all those guys on a basis where they make the profit and the government takes all the taxpayer takes all the risk. Not pretty, but there's no doubt there's a crunch coming. I'm working off the Wednesday close, by the way. It was clearly a bad week in the stock market. So the market is still great for the year, but it's still it's still falling. It could have a bad month. And October usually is remember, it's the rutting season for deer and many animals, but it's also in Washington when everybody fights, and if the market gets in trouble, it's by the end of the month. Remember, we don't have a budget yet. We just have a continuing resolution, so it's doing remarkably well, considering the night of the long knives here. The S&P up 16.87%, so underperforming treasuries by 4 points. What's interesting, and so the question is, are people taking profits? I listened to one podcast today, and I have to check this out, but it says the Yale Endowment's allocation for U.S. stocks in 2020 is 2.7% and 5 times greater for foreign stocks. And it's interesting because Mnuchin is skull and bones. So the question is, you know, does that tell us something about what Yale believes? As I said, 0 days for the brokerage accounts. They're doing a race to the bottom on commissions. The home builders up 32.47% for the year. VGK, the European ETF, up 9.53%. Germany up 5.58%. The WTO ruled in favor of the U.S. on a big Airbus case that started before the Trump administration. I believe it started in Obama. But the result was that Trump then got to put tariffs on European goods. So there's going to be more hard feelings, no doubt about that. Developed markets minus North America up 9.92%. The Chinese now up for the year, large caps 2.53% and small caps up 3.52%. Trump threatened last week to a U.S. delisting for Chinese stocks. There's no doubt the Chinese stocks are listing without having to be subject to the standard SEC requirements, and there's something very wrong there. A couple months ago, I had for Let's Go to the Movies a great documentary on it's called The China Hustle, and the problems with real fraud in Chinese stocks. They just don't, they don't have the infrastructure that we once upon a time had. And Kyle Bass tweeted out about how wrong this was and how right Trump was to hold them accountable. And I tweeted back and I said, wait a minute, FASB 56 just took the whole U.S. stock market dark. So, I agree that the Chinese have a problem, but we do too. So this needs to get fixed all around. The Chinese had their 70th anniversary of the People's Republic, and she showed up in a Mao suit. kind of basically reminding everybody, okay, so we're not a democracy, we're a one-party system. Anyway, it was a very impressive military show, and it was certainly meant to be very impressive. The reality is that if you look at how much global reserves are in the Chinese currency, it's up above 1% now, but it's not growing fast. It's not growing significantly. And the reality is nobody trusts the Chinese, and certainly Hong Kong isn't helping. We see an announcement that the Chinese in Hong Kong, the Hong Kong government is saying protesters were not allowed to wear masks. And that's definitely a hardball threat. We'll see what happens. Emerging markets up 3.88%, commodities up 1.85%. As I've been saying, this year, I think gold and silver will have a good year, and they have. Gold's up 16.5%, so almost in line with the S&P. Silver up 13.15%. But I see nothing on the horizon that are going to make people feel safe. So gold and silver should continue to have a good year. Oil up 19%. There's a great interview that Rob Kirby did with Greg Hunter about oil and the dollar and the extent to which we have a lot of uneconomic oil and gas activities going on in the U.S. because we need the oil and gas to prop up the dollar. And I agree with that. Although Kirby's much more negative short run on the dollar than I am, I think we both see the problems long run. Some more stories I wanted to mention. Farrell had a great piece on phased array retrofit of Navy ships and engaged in some high-octane speculation that HAARP delivery may now be mobile. Very interesting thought. One of the things we talked about is the fact there are all sorts of explosions going on. He mentioned a whole bunch. We have more. An explosion at a Warren Buffett factory in France. We had a stabbing in the Paris police station. Paris police being the people who are dealing with the yellow jackets. The French saying they're going to face recognition. Anyway, and so if you look at all these sort of strange behaviors, we saw a bridge in Taiwan fall down this week. And after a typhoon had come through, and you almost wonder, okay, was that really just the bridge falling down, or is there more of a story there? Anyway, but you can see the covert war is sort of breaking out all over. India continues to pressure down on Pakistan and Kashmir. We see comments from the prime minister in the president in Pakistan about the possibility of nuclear war. And one of my questions is, do the Silk Road investors feel very nervous about a Muslim country having nuclear weapons, which Pakistan does? And is this about getting nuclear control, sort of getting gun control in the Muslim countries? It wouldn't surprise me if that was what this was about. Just like I think Ukraine, somebody posted a great comment about how Israel wants to repatriate a lot of people to Ukraine. Because in the worst case, they have real reasons to worry about safety issues in the Middle East. But I think one reason they definitely want to plop down in Ukraine is they want to plop down a lot of money in the Ukraine because it's smack dab in the middle of the Silk Road. And it's a major equity position along the Silk Road. But part of plopping down there is clearing out some of the nuclear weapons. And so I think Pakistan is in for a real targeting here. I wanted to just say something about weaponizing children because we did have quite a scene at the UN with Greta Thunberg's speech. There is a long history of using children for political means, from the Salem witch trials to Hitler Youth to the Cultural Revolution in China. If you've read Orwell's book, The Animal Farm, you can sense some of the possibilities. There's no doubt there is a push to get much greater direct control by the government of children's minds and bodies. We just saw a new law pass in Michigan that says that healthcare professionals can ask the parents to leave the room and have private talks with the child without the parents being allowed to know what it is. When I tweeted it out, somebody on Twitter said you ought to mic up your kid and record what they're talking about, which I thought was a very good idea. They could probably put you in jail for that if you look at how the law works. But there's no doubt that they want to get the voting laws or age down, because then they can get the draft age down and they can get the consensual sex age down. So if you look at what's going on, it's deeply perverted. And you have to remember that a section of the leadership absolutely practice occult practices. They believe in pedophilia. They believe in human sacrifice. They do this. It's one of the things Joseph and I talk about. So this stuff is very dangerous. And of course, the question for all of us is, where do we and how do we oppose it and protect our kids? And one of the things you're going to have to do is keep your kids off the screens as much as possible, because the amount of sort of bad habits and bad behavior they're teaching the kids is really poisonous. Finally, I occasionally get questions from people about how to look to their, understand and due diligence on their state financial picture and pension funds. Truth in Accounting just came out with a new great state report. We've posted it, but you definitely, if you're, you really should know what your state and local finances are, but I recommend that you take a look at the Truth in Accounting state report. More bad news. I just had to tell you this story because it's an example of what I think is social breakdown. One of our subscribers in New York was walking from yoga class at 21st between Park and Lexington and saw someone in a relatively nice car, approximately 40 years old, clearly has a very nice income, but basically, say somebody making $150,000 to $200,000 a year, got out of the car and simply in front of everybody just took a leak right into the street right there. Now, if you know New York very well, you know it's relatively easy to find a Starbucks or other coffee shop where you can use the bathroom. So I would say that this describes a breakdown of impulse control. And when people are angry enough that they don't care enough to plan ahead so that they can find something, you know, that's the kind of thing that used to happen in Calcutta all the time. But it's sad to see New York and people who clearly have a good education and income behaving like they did once upon a time in Calcutta. But my concern is it's just a little signal of the sort of breakdown of society that happens. And I think it's very, very important for all of us to realize that this is our opportunity. Our opportunity is to nurture culture, nurture human civilization, and literally turn to the people who say, look, if you're going to go into a serious debasement down, go without us, you know, I pray for you, but I'm letting you go because I'm going to do the reverse. I'm going to spiral up. Some good news. I don't remember if I talked about it last week. I might, or 2 weeks ago, but I might have. The NRA, San Francisco, the Board of Supervisors came out and declared the NRA a national terrorist organization. And which is a very dangerous thing if you let things like that go on. So the National Rifle Association bought a lawsuit and they ended up settling. But it looks like the NRA truly came out ahead. The San Francisco is backing down. In a formal memo to city officials, San Francisco Mayor London Breed declared that, quote, no municipal department will take steps to restrict any contractor from doing business with the NRA or to restrict city contracting opportunities for any business that has any relationship with the NRA. The memo declares resolutions making policy statements do not impose duties on city departments, change any of the city's existing laws or policy, or control city departments' exercise of discretion. And so the NRA said, through these actions and our public advocacy, we hope the message is now clear. Anyway, I thought, bravo. Our hero this week is Boone Pickens, and I chose Boone Pickens. He was a good friend to one of our subscribers, and I've gotten regaled over the last few years by great Boone Pickens stories, but I always knew about Boone Pickens. When I was on Wall Street, I was in the energy group at one point at Dillon Reed, and Boone had started to be a raider. He had built Mesa Petroleum to one of the largest independent oil companies. And then he realized, you know, I can buy oil cheaper on the stock on the floor of the New York Stock Exchange than what I can drill for. So he was basically arbitraging the cost of drilling versus the cost of picking up a company cheap in the stock market. Interest rates had gone up and there were, you know, there were problems in the economy. Anyway, so he became a raider, and it was a matter of great frustration because I was very impressed. I thought he knew what he was doing. And I agreed. I was working with some companies who were paying, you know, way double, triple what you could buy the same barrel of oil for in the stock exchange. So I wanted to play along and play follow the leader with Boone Pickens, and my husband was deeply opposed to it. It was very frustrating because if we'd done it, we would have made a huge amount of money. Anyway, but he, I put up a video of different people at Oklahoma State University where he had gone and was a great supporter about the fact that, you know, for all the money he made, he gave away tremendous amounts. He was a real take action guy. He really believed in, you know, there's a problem. Okay, let's go solve it. Let's just do it. He was, I would say, somebody who was bigger than life, and he was very concerned about the United States and where things were headed in the last 10 or 20 years and really tried to do things. So one of the things I've always loved America is in America, you were taught to think big, big hearts, big minds, you know, big risk-taking. Let's go do it. It's one of the things I always loved about the people in the independent oil patch. That's one of the reasons I enjoyed working in the energy group. But Boone Pickens was he had a big heart and a big mind, and he was a big guy. And it's kind of spirit that made America great. Our interview tonight is the third quarter wrap-up, News Trends and Stories Part 1, which is Economy and Geopolitics with Dr. Joseph Farrell. It's such a pleasure to do these. We put a tremendous amount of time into collecting up all the stories. Brad Edens, who is our News Trends and Stories editor, does an absolutely fantastic job. And it goes on for weeks as we sort through what happened and really distill out the important things for you to know. My goal with this is you're really busy. You got better things to do than listen to the news, especially because it seems so incoherent. And so what we try and do is distill everything down. So if you just listen to News Trends and Stories four times a year, you can ignore the news for the rest of the year and you'll have a better idea of what's going on than most people. So our goal is to really get you a real synthesis and help you be able to navigate. I want you to have a good map of the world so you can navigate. Anyway, if you go to the web presentation, you can click from the commentary at the homepage for this Solari report, and I'll have a link to the web presentation. You just click over. It should log you in automatically as long as you log in when you first get to the homepage. And you'll see the News Trends and Stories section, and it's got all of the different trends and stories, and then it's got the headlines within each of the stories, so you can explore, get a sense, and then for each part, part one and part two, we have top videos for the quarter, including video. We go back and get some very old ones that are pertinent. So there was a little bit of a debate this quarter about weather control and whether man really has the ability to manipulate the weather. So I pulled up a old video of Lyndon Johnson talking about how we're going to be able to control the world by controlling the weather. I also put up a commentary with Mark Skidmore, just published, co-authored a piece that included a bibliography. It's weather, sort of a history of weather management for economists. And it's got a great bibliography. And what you can see is there's a lot been going on for a long time. Anyway, so I really hope you enjoy this. We had some pretty serious conversations, but it was always a pleasure. And I always leave these really understanding better than when I started through the process. Anyway, so I hope you enjoy it. If you look at the commentary or the chapters, you can listen by chapter, and it will show you the top five stories in economy, five stories in geopolitics. And let's go to the movies. I wanted to touch base on a new documentary, Untouchable, The Rise and Fall of Harvey Weinstein. It gives you a sense for the financial coup period because Weinstein was a real power broker in the New York elites during that period. Once the coup was over and the Clintons lost the 2016 election, Weinstein joined the ranks of the expendables. You know, one of the things that really brought him down was his involvement in the targeting by the Me Too movement, because he had raped and sexually pressured and abused a tremendous number of women, pretty much adults. So it's not a bad whiteout for the Epstein story or Pizzagate, because what was going on at the time was even far worse than what Weinstein was up to, but what you see is how out of control it is. If you go back and look at the story of Epstein or Weinstein, all these people are clearly doing what they're doing, and nobody around them is stopping them or objecting. And what's extraordinary is how bad they were for how long and the extent to which everybody facilitated and went along with it. It's kind of scary because it's a lot of people going along with the sort of raping and using of other people, or particularly young people. Now, if you look at what's going on, I think the worst has not come out about sort of deep sexual perversion and the Luciferian and occult practices. We talk about it in the interview. Joseph brings up the extent to which human sacrifice is happening. You know, it's clearly happening in the false flags. There's no doubt about that. But you have among certain groups in the leadership, people who really don't care what things look like. Now they're getting more and more bold about what they're doing and how they're doing it. I mean, think about with everything that's come out, what they've gotten away with. And that's why I think the trust the plan with Q is so damaging, because it's been part of facilitating the you know, people standing down while they wait for the magic cure that never comes. But if you look at the Obamas going out and buying a $15 million mansion next to the ocean in Martha's Vineyard, you know, they don't care that they, you know, that they're obvious that they think climate change is a joke while they're running around and promoting global taxation systems for climate change. Okay, ask Catherine. So this one's long, but I think I'm going to try and read most of it. Dear Catherine, this is a simple note from a simple subscriber who appreciates all you do on the Slayer Report and for your fearless resolve and leadership. As a Christian, I wanted to first thank you and send my wholehearted support and prayer of thanks for your frequent and courageous reference to Jesus Christ in your talks and writings. These references, in my opinion, are oh so risky, but oh so key in making the real difference we seem to all be looking for in the world. Your quiet confidence and subtlety of approach to bring Christ into people's consciousness is wonderful, and my prayer is that you continue to bear much fruit in the service of Christ and God's plan overall. I loved your recent talk about access to divine intelligence. It was so thought-provoking and drove me into reading and thinking about all kinds of related topics. One thought I had related to that talk was about how giving more insight into the divine seems important as a complement. In your talk with Mr. Meyer, you proposed a brain structure to first hear what Steiner had to say about integrity, then you proposed to walk through what Christ had to say about integrity. Unless I missed something through the dynamics of that great dialogue, I don't think you got to the part in your conversation, perhaps in part two. As I see it, without Christ as the reference point for integrity, the risk is integrity can become as hollow as the many other godless terms as liberty, equality, fraternity from the great counterfeit of unity known as the French Revolution, or compassion, community, and kindness in the New Age movement. As a Christian, of course, no one has set the bar higher for integrity or any other virtues than Jesus Christ, and so he is my only reference point for the divine. To someone else, it might be other divine figureheads, that is, to paraphrase Steiner, may well be pre-Christian mystery figures that folks haven't yet associated with Christ, but would eventually if they go to the end of their spiritual quest on earth. As a Christian, I accept that this is where such folks are on their path, and I have to trust God's plan for all of us. At the other extremes, Satanists can be considered to also have access to the divine. It's just another type of spiritual, superior spiritual force. The risk to we humans is in these confused times is when divinity is not defined in terms of Jesus, but in terms of what I think, what I feel, what I want, all forms of self-defined gods that have flourished over time and more so in the past century of self. Getting folks to rally around virtuous words is not that hard when you see all the virtue signaling in the media, social justice, etc. Getting folks to rally around virtues that are solidly rooted on God, goodness, charity, which in the true Christian sense includes selflessness, forgiveness, loving one's enemies, willful suffering, humility, detachment from things of this world, even self-effacement is really hard. I see Jordan Peterson has tried to convey rationality, the value of goodness and integrity in such terms, even if he isn't a declared Christian, but doing so publicly with Jesus at the center is as hard and risky as ever in this world. So I think I understand you when you express how you feel it's hard to get folks to understand the value of integrity and the importance of Christ. It is hard. Folks have died for it over the centuries. There is no denying Getting this message across is hard. Anyone suggesting it's easy, I think, is not focused on pushing the real message of Christ-centric integrity, among other virtues. That you might express to find it hard indicates from this angle that you are exactly on the right path. Satan doesn't want you nor other Christians to be successful, apparently. No surprise there. I get concerned that the deep and persistent deep state tactics against the Catholic Church and Christianity over the years and centuries have been so effective that folks end up throwing baby Jesus out with the so-called bathwater and pushed with society's message that anything goes. We all end up having totally different sets of morals and references, which further weakens our collective position and coherence. I also am concerned with related tactics to usurp, absorb, envelop, and ultimately smother all useful views into the grand new world religion. Amen to that. It is evident how someone like Steiner and many others like him can be and risk being absorbed into a new age religion that has obscured, even abandoned, the mystery of Jesus Christ. I don't know how much you've read about Steiner's writings on Christ, but I find them to be very illuminating and inspiring. So if you haven't read The Mystery of Golgotha, I would start there. In a sense, what Mr. Global is doing to our food, they are also doing to Christianity and spirituality more broadly. That's a great, I couldn't agree more. Dumbing it down and weakening all of us spiritually. The signs of a broken and bruised church abound. Christians divided in all directions, East versus West, Catholics versus Protestants, traditionalists versus modernists. I want to stop there. I can't tell you how many churches, great churches, I've seen destroyed by the whole LGBT effort. It was very clever the way it was done. Preventing coherent Christian prayer, intention, and action. Christians and Muslims all too divided, the common men and women of both faith, moral relativism within the church itself, and dumbing down of Christians away from the truths that the great Christian thinkers and martyrs have left us for the instruction and edification. I believe none of this is accidental. Given all such tactics, it seems the Sanhedrin never disbanded, really, and it is a small miracle that Christians still exist on the planet in 2019. My hope, shared by many, is that Christ's broken body church of today will resuscitate to new life with a much stronger and renewed Christianity soon, and it's actions like yours at the Solari Report that are helping bring this new church to life. What matters most, in my opinion, at this stage for humanity is to shift gears and learn to fight the spiritual fight with equal spiritual weapons, our God versus theirs. We need to realize our place in this battle between spiritual principalities, read St. Paul, Ephesians, and our very limited, if not futile, role as humans in this battle unless we are empowered and grounded in God, Jesus. Any simple human action that is not empowered and grounded in God, faith, as I see it, will not prevail against the cunning spiritual power of Satan, Ahriman, whatever you want to call it, and his forces, lies, and deceit. Now, that's been my experience. I couldn't agree more. It's not until man realizes his dependence on God and his secondary nature to God that we can be effective against the evil principalities. It seems many well-intentioned folks don't realize the degree to which our enemies fully realize and appreciate the importance of accessing the divine, and they do so in inverted ways via veneration of their own gods to get their powers. The Luciferic forces fully recognize Christ even by name. Satanists seem to fully appreciate the power of the Eucharist and the Christian Mass, hence the black masses and stealing of hosts. And yet too many of us are on the side of God, remain uncommitted to prayer, to the virtues, and to veneration of our God, which is the only true answer to all of this evil-induced chaos. I sense you have repeatedly tried to convey this to your audience, but from my humble experience, it is less and very tough to get across. As I see it, what is foundational in the story of Gideon is that Gideon was a man of faith, disposed to hearing and obeying the Lord. Gideon was faithful enough in the eyes of the Lord to be receptive to grace, the grace of trusting in God, and of being trusted, empowered, guided by God in the battle. In this story, as with J.S. Bach, God did not empower an unbeliever and ultimately told his anointed Gideon to retain only the fearless, the most vigilant, the most disposed to operating exactly as their leader commanded them, ultimately the most disposed to listen and execute God's will. Watch me and do as I do, Gideon said. When I come to the outskirts of the camp, do exactly as I do. Christ said he didn't come to unify everyone in a big lovey-dovey world peace, but he came to turn a man against his father, a daughter against her mother, and a daughter-in-law against her mother-in-law. I think many of us are seeing this happen as our society seems to be more and more demarcated based on truth, faith, hope versus lies, deceit, nihilism, Christ versus the satanic, the awake versus the asleep. Amidst all your insights and education about so many matters of the world, I sense somewhere the Solari Report is ultimately about inviting and helping folks cross the divide into true faith and hope and charity in service of Christ's mission versus serving the opposite. Perhaps this is just my Christian projection, but reading between the Solari lines, this is what I'm sensing. What is a free and inspired life if not a life based on Christ? But alas, it's so touchy to clamor this publicly. God, give us the strength in our missions, whatever they might be. So in short, I thought your talk on access to divine intelligence was superb and the theme so central to our collective success. I really hope you continue with such talks, as I really enjoy the way you talk about such things. Again, I greatly admire your courage and determination not only in disclosing the world realities as you are doing, but also that you're doing this with a Christian backdrop, with a uniquely Christian undertone that is all too rare these days, that such a respected, accomplished, intelligent voice as yours also profess faith in Jesus Christ is wonderful and very potent. May you and the Solari Report get many graces from your actions and fearlessness, and may the potency of your words, reports, and insights always grow. Well, I wanted to read that whole thing because I thought there was many very powerful insights in it, and I very much appreciate your taking the time to send it. As I've said several times before, I don't think of myself as being called to minister, and yet I can't imagine. somebody posted the other night on the website saying, you know, ask me a long, complicated question about how to deal with all these things. And I think I had just come in from a long 20-hour drive or something. And I said, the only thing I can think of to say is I can do all things through Christ. So for me, my life and my view of the world is very, very Christ-centric. And I'm a Christian, and that's my practice. But I have also spent a lot of time driving around America and visiting churches and being appalled at the state of Christianity, and also being appalled at the state of many of the Christians who try and persuade other people to become Christians. And so I don't know how to tell somebody how to discover this. I think everybody has to discover this for themselves. I had the advantage during the litigation of being forced to go listen to a whole series of great preachers who basically, you know, I was there to have them teach me how to stay alive when you're being targeted in the way that I was, because I knew they knew how to do it. But of course, I discovered something much more powerful and deeper than I ever expected. And certainly the preachers help, but ultimately you have to come to this on your own. It's a pathway you have to find by yourself. And it's really between you and God, and you have to work it out together, and you have to build the pathway yourself, and you have to decide what you believe is your path. I can't tell you. And so I'm very big on having people take responsibility. And this, of course, is the biggest, most important responsibility they'll ever take. And I don't believe it's possible to be a sovereign human being without first establishing the foundation of your spiritual life. Anyway, so I struggle because I don't think it can be explained intellectually. I don't think your spiritual life is, it has to come out of a very deep, intuitive, almost biophysical understanding. And you have to be able to access, you know, Christ is everywhere. He's all around. And you have to be able to access and connect to the Holy Spirit. And I have no idea how to tell anyone to do it. I can tell you all sorts of preachers to listen to that I listen to. I can tell you all sorts of practices to sort of connect with the universe physically and the, you know, sort of connect your electromagnetic field to all the energy that's in the available to us, but I have no idea how to explain this with words. So the best that I can do, if you look at my life versus the the teachings of Christ, all I see is immense opportunity for improvement in my life. And so I try and focus on that, and then I try and live the teachings as best I can, and in that sense I can demonstrate, but I'm just not called to be a preacher. That's not what I do. And but on occasion I'm happy to talk about it. It's just it's something you have to experience. Anyway, and I've absolutely had many profound spiritual experiences. One of the things that is interesting is if you look at what it's like to to have a spat with all the money on the planet, we have planet-wide the forces of hypermaterialism with extraordinary resources, including financial resources and military resources, intelligence resources, surveillance resources, and they all point to one way and clearly communicate that resistance is hopeless. However, if you understand Christ, if you're connected to Christ and you understand physics, you know there's always another way, and that it only takes a very small number of people to shift it and to shift that way. So I think if you're not going to buy into the one way of hypermaterialism and you're not going to buy into hopelessness, you have to the only way I know to do it is through Christ. Now, I'm sure that there are Buddhists or people of other faiths that would tell me, no, their faith works. And for them, I'm sure it does. It's, to me, what's important is you find that and you understand enough about the nature of spiritual reality so that when the hypermaterialists point out that it's all hopeless and you have to do what they say, you know, it's just not true. New response. Dr. Mercola just emailed this piece with an excellent summary of the U.S. government frauds on vaccines and their very serious danger. It includes free streaming of the vax video, which I just watched. It is overwhelming. Thought you might want to post this. Yes, great article. Another great article by Mercola. And I posted the announcement of the vax video, and I can't recommend it enough. We've had it on Let's Go to the Movies, and I really think if you're interested in the vaccine issue, there's some great resources on the Salieri Report, but a recommendation of Vax is one of them. Hi, Catherine. Have you heard of a CIA-related pedophilia group known as the Finders? If not, please click on the link below and listen a few minutes in from 28 minutes. Yes, we did a Salieri Report about 2 years ago with John Rappaport and pedophilia, and there was a great movie from a Salieri Report subscriber who made it. It was her first production, and it's marvelous. And it's on the Finders. So go find that John Rappaport and get that, get a look at that movie because it's really good. Hi, Catherine. I really enjoyed listening to your interview from 2013 with Dan Hillard of Life Source Water Systems. I was wondering if you had any updates on your own experience with whole house water filters since the interview, because you voiced some displeasure with the system you had at the time. I'm looking into options for a home system that filters out almost all fluoride, which Life Source apparently does not. My system, I'm continuing to use my system. They're just, they don't make them anymore. There's a company that does the filters, but the company that I bought it from is no longer in operating. I have my own well, so my concern was poison being put down the well. It's one of the reasons I did it. I was also concerned about being in a farming community, whether pesticides could get into the water table. I think it's exceptionally important to filter for fluoride, so I would encourage you to keep doing that. I just posted a story last week, new study out, that says fluoride reduces the IQ levels in men by as much as 5 points. So if you look at what's going on, you can definitely use those 5 points. Don't drink fluoride. Anyway, did you see these charts? And somebody sent the charts of the repo market spiking up. Yes, that's what a short-term liquidity trap looks like. I don't find it anywhere near as frightening as some of the websites were implying. Because obviously the Fed's stepped in. And I think we're going to see those kind of liquidity hiccups a lot more. And unfortunately, it's going to cause the central banks to print more money. And when they do, it's going to cause more inequality and all the problems we're seeing, including greater price inflation. Then someone sent a article on the Senate Banking Committee related to the Federal Reserve is working on a new real-time payment system. And one of the things the article was concerned about was whether the Fed would be allowed to cannibalize the market with that system. And the answer is, of course, it's one of the reasons they're doing it. One way to avoid that is if the states did banks like North Dakota is doing, that created their own real-time payment mechanism with each other and their member banks, it would help protect us. And I think I would love to see the states all have banks like North Dakota. This has happened to another golf course in the so-called Southern California Inland Empire area that is not mentioned in this article. Here's an article on the one. It's called The Retreat, which is a Jack Nicholson design course. And it's talking about developers trying to put residential on a golf course. And if the members don't approve it, they shut down the golf course. And then you said, could you do another meetup in Southern California? I really enjoyed the one not so long ago in Pasadena. Thank you for your unique insights and deep actionable intelligence. That's fascinating about the golf course. I think there's just going to be more and more sort of predatory development. And my concern with privatization after the 2020 election is I just think the real estate grab is going to be on steroids. So it's something to be very concerned about. We don't have an event planned for California for this year. We have to see how the political process intentions work out next year, because I want to be a little bit careful. The politics of California, given the tensions between the federal government and California and some of the disaster capitalism things going on in California, are very, I think, seriously dangerous. More problems on the website. Somebody was writing in about the website didn't work one morning, and we showed no downtime or denial of service attacks. So I went back and I said, do you use AT&T as an ISP? And they said, yes. I said, I'm sorry. You know, unfortunately, you just can't use AT&T because they're going to censor content. And we have an article describing all of our historical problems with AT&T. It took us after, I think it was a year and a half to finally get them accepting our emails again. But, who knows what could happen. So I would encourage you, if you want to access the Solari report. And here's the other thing. If you have a phone company or an ISP that censors you and doesn't tell you that they're censoring you, if you've asked to receive an email from us, but they won't let it through and they haven't told you, you know, I don't think that's somebody you want to do business with. And it wouldn't surprise me if we're going to get to the point in this country or in the world where communities have to put together their own telecom systems and network with each other, because the extent to which you're going to use these private corporations to censor and control is only going to rise for some period of time until the pushback is big enough. Okay, that's it for this week. Next week we have part two with Dr. Farrell. Then we'll go into the equity overview on the week of October 17th. October 24th, our next science series with Ulrich Groniger, The Mathematics of the Genetic Code. Fascinating stuff. Then on October 3rd, I'm going to be, Ulrich and Nina Hein and Robert and I are going to be in Paris looking at the Da Vinci website, and we're going to publish Leonardo da Vinci and the Power of Our Imagination with John Rappaport, and then I'll do the take action theme for the third quarter wrap-up when I get back to Hickory Valley in early November. So I look forward to that, because it's very important that we all take action. Each one of us is unique and our circumstances are unique, but we take action in whatever way is energizing and appropriate for us, because enough people take action, it's amazing what you can get done. So that's it for this week, ladies and gentlemen. Until next week, please remember, don't worry about whether or not there is a conspiracy. If you're not in a conspiracy, you need to start one. Good night and good luck.